This is Audible.
One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. Peter Lynch has managed the Fidelity Magellan Fund since 1977. His investment record has been spectacular. Time magazine called him the number one money manager in America, and Fortune said he is the most successful in his field in the 1980s, a superstar investor. If you had invested $10,000 in 1977 when Peter Lynch became manager of the fund, your investment would be worth $240,000 as of mid-1989. In this program, a Simon & Schuster presentation, Peter Lynch explains how individual investors can learn about potentially successful companies long before the Wall Street analysts do. This jump on the experts is what can produce a 10-bagger, a stock that appreciates tenfold or more, the stock that turns an average portfolio into a star performer. Whether you're an experienced investor or just starting out, Peter Lynch will help you to pick out winning stocks. Who knows? A 10-bagger may be right around the corner.
At this point, I'm supposed to promise I'll share the secrets of my success as a professional stock market investor. But rule number one is stop listening to professionals. 20 years in this business has convinced me that any normal person, using the customary 3% of his or her brain power, can pick stocks as well, if not better, than the average Wall Street expert. I know you don't expect the plastic surgeon to advise you to do your own facelift. You don't want the plumber to tell you to install your own hot water tank. But this isn't surgery or plumbing. This is investing, where the smart money isn't so smart and the dumb money isn't so dumb. Dumb money is only dumb when it listens to the smart money. In fact, the amateur investor has many built-in advantages that can result in outperforming the experts. When you pick your own stocks, you should outperform the experts. Otherwise, why bother? Once you've decided to invest individually, try going it alone. This means ignoring the hot tips, recommendations from brokerage houses, and the latest can't-miss suggestion from your favorite newsletter. It also means you should ignore the stocks you hear Peter Lynch or some similar authority is buying. You've got better sources than Peter Lynch, and they're all around you. What makes your sources so good is that you can keep tabs on them. You can pick spectacular performers from your place of business or out of your neighborhood shopping mall long before Wall Street will find them. It's impossible to be a credit card carrying American consumer while having done a lot of fundamental analysis on dozens of companies. This is where you'll find the 10 baggers. I've seen it happen over and over from my perch at Fidelity. In the language of Wall Street, a 10-bagger is a stock in which you've made 10 times your money. I suspect this technical term has been borrowed from baseball, which goes up to a 4-bagger or a home run. In my business, a 4-bagger is nice, but a 10-bagger is a whole lot better. You might assume it's the sophisticated gossip that experts hear around Quotron machines, which give us our best investment ideas. But I stumble onto the potential big winners in extracurricular situations, the same way you can. For instance, I was impressed with the Taco Bell burrito on a trip to California. Somebody at the rival Holiday Inn told me about La Quinta Motor Inns. My family and friends drive Volvos. My kids had an Apple computer at home, and then the systems manager bought several for our office. I loved the coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. My wife recommended the revamped Pier 1 imports. In fact, Carolyn is one of my best sources. She's the one who discovered Legs. Legs is the perfect example of the power of common knowledge. It turned out to be one of the most successful consumer products of the 70s. In the early part of that decade, I was working as a securities analyst at Fidelity. I knew the textile business. I visited textile plants, calculated profit margins, and learned the esoterica of warps and woofs. But none of this information was as valuable as Carolyn's. I didn't find Legs in any of my research. She found it by going to the grocery store. Carolyn didn't need to be a textile analyst to realize that Legs was a superior product. All she had to do was buy a pair and try them on. Two or three years after the product was introduced, you could have walked into any one of thousands of supermarkets and realized this product was a bestseller. From there, it was easy enough to find out that Legs was made by Hanes, and Hanes was listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Hanes turned out to be a six-bagger before it was taken over by Consolidated Foods, which is now called Sara Lee. Legs still makes a lot of money for Sara Lee and has continued to grow consistently over the past decade. I'm convinced Hanes would have been a 50-bagger if it hadn't been bought out. You didn't have to know about Legs from the outset. You could have bought Hanes stock during the first, second, or third year after Legs went nationwide, and you could have tripled your money. The nice thing about investing in familiar companies like Legs or Dunkin' Donuts is that when you try on the stockings or sip the coffee, you're doing the kind of basic analysis Wall Street analysts are paid to do. Visiting stores and testing products is one of the critical elements of an analyst's job. During a lifetime of car buying, you develop a sense of what's good and what's bad. If you don't know about cars, you do know about something else. Why wait for the Merrill Lynch restaurant expert to recommend Dunkin' Donuts when you've already noticed 8 new franchises opening up in your area? The Merrill Lynch analyst isn't going to notice Dunkin' Donuts until the stock has gone from $2 to $10. But you noticed it when the stock was at $2. For some reason, amateur investors usually don't consider eating donuts a sophisticated initial investigation into equities. People seem more comfortable investing in something they know nothing about. There seems to be an unwritten rule on Wall Street. If you don't understand it, put your life savings into it. Shun the enterprise around the corner, which can be observed, and seek out the one making an incomprehensible product. Does this mean I think you should buy shares in every business with a hot product? The answer is no. Finding the promising company is the first step. The next step is doing the research. The Fidelity Magellan Mutual Fund has risen over 24-fold per share during the last 12 years. This is partly due to some of the little-known, out-of-favor stocks I've discovered and researched on my own. Any investor can benefit from the same tactics. It doesn't take much to outsmart the smart money, which, as I've said, isn't always so smart.
Before you think about buying stocks, you should answer some basic questions about the market. How much do you trust corporate America? Do you need to invest in stocks? What do you expect to get from them? Are you a short-term or a long-term investor? How will you react to sudden price drops? Do you believe stocks are riskier than bonds? It's best to define your objectives and clarify your attitudes before you begin investing. You are a potential market victim if you're undecided and lack conviction. Personal preparation is as important as research when it comes to separating the successful stock picker from the chronic loser. In this section called Preparing to Invest, Peter Lynch will tell you what you're up against and how you can best ensure your own success. Chapter 1, The Making of a Stock Picker.
There's no such thing as a hereditary knack for picking stocks. Many would like to blame their losses on a genetic flaw. They believe others are somehow born to invest. My own history refutes that idea. There was no ticker tape above my cradle, and I didn't teethe on the stock pages. Most of my relatives distrusted the stock market. My mother was the youngest of 7 children, and my aunts and uncles reached adulthood during the Great Depression. They had first-hand knowledge of the crash of 1929. Distrust of stocks was the prevailing American attitude throughout the 1950s and into the 1960s. During that time, the market tripled and then doubled again. This period was truly the greatest bull market in history, not the 1980s. My father died when I was 10 and my mother had to go to work. I wanted to help out, so I got a part-time job as a caddy. I began to understand the more important aspects of caddying when I was in high school. My clients were the presidents and CEOs of major corporations, including Gillette, Polaroid, and more to the point, Fidelity. In helping D. George Sullivan find his ball, I was helping myself to find a career. The golf course was the next best thing to being on the floor of a major exchange. After my clients sliced the drive, they enthusiastically described their latest investment. The happy stories I heard on the fairways made me rethink the family position that the stock market was a place to lose money. Many of my clients seemed to be making money in the stock market. I continued to caddy throughout high school and into college. I was on the liberal arts side of Boston College, avoiding all the required math and accounting courses, the normal preparations for business. Instead, I studied metaphysics, logic, and philosophy, along with history, psychology, and political science. Investing in stocks is an art, not a science. People trained to rigidly quantify everything are at a disadvantage. If stock picking could be quantified, you could rent time on the nearest Cray computer and make a fortune. But it doesn't work that way. I applied for a summer job at Fidelity during my senior year. This was at Mr. Sullivan's suggestion, Fidelity's president for whom I had caddied. I was thrilled to be hired at Fidelity. Summer interns like me were put to work researching companies and writing reports just like the regular analysts. The whole business was suddenly demystified. Even a liberal arts major can analyze a stock. I went to Wharton after that interlude at Fidelity more skeptical than ever about the value of academic stock market theory. It seemed to me that most of what I was learning at Wharton could only help you fail in the investment business. I studied statistics, advanced calculus, and quantitative analysis. Quantitative analysis taught me that the things I saw happening at Fidelity couldn't really be happening. It was also obvious that the Wharton professors who believe in academic theories weren't doing nearly as well as my new colleagues at Fidelity. So I cast my lot with the practitioners, and my distrust of theorizers continues to this day. After serving my ROTC required 2-year hitch in the Army, I rejoined Fidelity as a research analyst in 1969. I was promoted to director of research in 1974, and in May 1977, I took over the Fidelity Magellan Fund. Fidelity Magellan had $20 million in assets and 40 stocks in the portfolio. My boss suggested I reduce the number to 25. I listened politely and raised the number to 60. 6 months later, to 100. Soon after that, to 150 stocks. I didn't do it to be contrary. I did it because I couldn't resist buying a bargain. There were bargains everywhere in those days. My portfolio continued to grow. Instead of settling for a couple of savings and loans, I bought them across the board after determining each was a promising investment. It wasn't enough for me to invest in one convenience store. I just had to buy Circle K, National Convenience, Shop and Go, and Hoppin' Foods, to mention a few. Pretty soon, I became known as the Will Rogers of equities, a man who never saw a stock he didn't like. Since I own 1,400 now, I guess they have a point. Actually, Will Rogers may have offered the best bit of advice about stocks. He said, "Don't gamble. Take all your savings and buy some good stock, and hold it till it goes up, then sell it. If it don't go up, don't buy it."
Chapter 2, The Wall Street Oxymorons.
To the list of famous oxymorons, which includes military intelligence, learned professor, deafening silence, and jumbo shrimp, I'd add professional investing. It's important to view the profession with skepticism. Since 70% of the shares in major companies are controlled by institutions, you're competing against oxymorons whenever you buy or sell stock. This is a lucky break for you. There are many cultural, legal, and social barriers limiting the professionals. Of course, not all professionals are oxymoronic. There are innovative fund managers who invest as they please, but the majority of the professional investors are hemmed in by the rules. The virtues of every spectacular stock I've found were so obvious that 99 out of 100 professionals would have wanted to add it to their portfolios. But for reasons I'm about to describe, they couldn't. There are simply too many obstacles between the professional investors and the 10 baggers. Take The Limited, for example. This company went public in 1969. Only one analyst followed the company for 5 years. A second analyst, Maggie Gilliam, noticed it in 1974. The first institution bought shares in The Limited in the summer of 1975 when there were 100 limited stores open for business across the country. By 1979, 10 years after going public and having sustained a brilliant record, only two institutions had bought the stock. 400 limited stores were doing a thriving business in 1981, and only six analysts were covering the company. When the stock hit its high of 9 in 1983, long-term investors were up 18-fold from 1979. The price fell to $5 a share in 1984. The company was still doing well. Investors got another chance to buy in. As I'll explain later, if a stock is down but the fundamentals are good, it's best to hold on and better to buy more. It wasn't until 1985, with the stock back up to $15 a share, that analysts put the limited on their buy lists. Aggressive institutional buying helped send the shares up to over $52, far beyond what the fundamentals justified. By then, there were more than 30 analysts on the trail. Many arrived just in time to see the limited drop. Contrast the story of the limited with the 56 brokerage analysts normally covering IBM. You haven't spent much time in Wall Street if you think the average Wall Street professional is looking for reasons to buy exciting stocks. The rare professional has the guts to buy into an unknown company. In fact, choosing between the chance to make a large profit on an unknown company and the assurance of losing a small amount on an established company, most fund managers jump at the established company. Success is one thing, but it's more important not to look bad if you fail. There's an unwritten rule on Wall Street which states, you'll never lose your job losing your client's money in IBM. Whenever fund managers do decide to buy something exciting, they may be held back by rules and regulations. Some bank trust departments won't allow stock purchases in companies with unions. Others won't invest in specific industry groups. It's the Securities and Exchange Commission making up the rules if it's not the mutual fund. For instance, the SEC says a mutual fund like Fidelity Magellan cannot own more than 10% of the shares in any company. It also says we cannot invest more than 5% of the fund's assets in any one stock. These restrictions are well-intentioned. They protect against the fund putting all its eggs in one basket. They also protect against the fund taking over a company. But the secondary result is that the larger funds are forced to limit themselves to the very large 500 companies out of the over 10,000 companies that are publicly traded. Fidelity Magellan has continued to compete successfully. For this, I have to thank the fast-growing stocks, the turnaround opportunities, and the out-of-favor enterprises I've found. The stocks I try to buy are the very stocks traditional fund managers try to overlook. In other words, I continue to think like an amateur as frequently as possible. An individual investor doesn't have to operate like an institution. You've got an edge already. The 10-baggers come from beyond the boundaries of what's accepted on Wall Street. Great opportunities can be found in your neighborhood or workplace. Better yet, you can find them months or even years before the news reaches the professionals. Then again, maybe you shouldn't have anything to do with the stock market at all. This is an issue worth discussing because the stock market demands conviction as surely as it victimizes the unconvinced.
Chapter 3. Is this gambling or what?
Many investors took refuge in bonds after the October 1987 crash. The issue of stocks versus bonds should be resolved up front, or it will come up at frantic moments, like when the stock market is dropping. Investing in bonds, money markets, or CDs are forms of investing in debt, for which one is paid interest. Traditionally, bonds were sold in large denominations, too large for the small investor. Bond funds were eventually invented. This made it possible for regular people to invest in debt along with the tycoons. Later, the money market fund liberated former passbook savers from the captivity of the banks. It's one thing to prefer stocks to a stodgy savings account yielding 5% forever. It's quite another to prefer them to a money market where the yields rise immediately if the interest rates go up. Stocks have paid off about 30 times better than treasury bills, in spite of crashes, depressions, wars, and recessions. There's a logical explanation for this. In stocks, you've got the company's growth on your side. You're a partner in a prosperous business. In bonds, you're nothing more than the nearest source of spare change. When you lend money to somebody, the best you can hope for is to get it back, plus interest. Unless you're a professional specializing in troubled companies and bankruptcies, the average person will never get a 10-bagger in a bond. Ah, yes, you say. But what about the risks? Aren't stocks riskier than bonds? Of course stocks are risky. Nowhere is it written, that stocks owe you anything. Even blue-chip stocks held long-term can be risky. The point is, fortunes change. There's no assurance major companies won't become minor. There's no such thing as a can't-miss blue chip. Buy the right stocks at the wrong price at the wrong time, and you'll suffer great losses. Frankly, there is no way to separate investing from gambling when dealing with stocks and bonds. There is no absolute division between safe and risky places to store money. In the late 1920s, common stocks were finally considered prudent investments. This was exactly when the overvalued market made buying stocks more of a wager than an investment. Stocks have been embraced as investments or dismissed as gambles in circular fashion, usually at the wrong times. Remember, stocks are most likely to be accepted as prudent at the moment they are not. Once the risk is accepted, we can begin to separate gambling from investing by the skill and dedication of the participant. To the stock picker who rushes in and out of equities, an investment in stocks is no more reliable than betting on the prettiest horse. To me, an investment is simply a gamble in which you've managed to tilt the odds in your favor. It doesn't matter whether it's Atlantic City or the stock market. You can learn which companies are likely to grow and prosper by asking a few questions. Although you can never be certain what will happen, each new occurrence, such as a jump in earnings, will indicate your likelihood of success. People who succeed in the stock market accept periodic losses and unexpected occurrences. Calamitous drops don't scare them out of the game. If they've done the proper homework before investing in a company and suddenly it deteriorates, they accept it and look for the next company. They realize the stock market is not a pure science. If 7 out of 10 of my stocks perform as expected, I'm delighted. If 6 out of 10 of my stocks perform as expected, I'm thankful. Remember, 6 out of 10 is all it takes to produce an enviable record on Wall Street. The greatest advantage to investing in stocks is the incredible reward for being right. If one invests $1,000 in a stock and he or she is wrong, all you can lose is $1,000. But if you're right, you can make $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000 over a long period of time. Clearly, the stock market can be a gamble worth taking, as long as you know how to play the game.
Chapter 4, Passing the Mirror Test.
If you find a stock that's a good investment, it doesn't mean you ought to own it. There's no point going any further until you've looked into the mirror. You should ask yourself three questions before you buy a share of anything. First, do I own a house? Second, do I need the money? And third, do I have the personal qualities that will bring me success in stocks? Whether stocks make good or bad investments depends more on your responses to these questions than anything you'll ever read in the Wall Street Journal. You should consider buying a house before you invest any money in stocks. A house is the one good investment almost everyone manages to make, and it is a moneymaker 99 times out of 100. Houses, like stocks, are most likely to be profitable when they're held for a long period of time. Unlike stocks, houses are likely to be owned by the same person for a number of years. You're a good investor in houses because you know how to poke around from the attic to the basement asking questions. Before you make an offer on a house, you hire experts to search for termites, roof leaks, dry rot, rusty pipes, faulty wiring, and cracks in the foundation. It's no wonder people make money in the real estate market and lose money in the stock market. They spend months choosing their houses and only minutes choosing their stocks. This brings us to the second question. Do I need the money? Review your budget before you buy stocks. For instance, if you're going to pay for a child's college education in a few years, don't put that money into stocks. In this instance, even buying blue-chip stocks is too risky to consider. These stocks are relatively predictable over 10 to 20 years. But as to whether they're going to be higher or lower in 2 to 3 years, well, you might as well flip a coin. Blue chips can fall and stay down for as long as 5 years. If you've invested in blue chips and the market hits a banana peel, well, your kid is going to go to night school. Maybe you're an older person living on a fixed income. Stay out of the stock market. There are lots of complicated formulas to figure out what percentage of your assets should be put into stocks, but mine is simple. It's the same for Wall Street as it is for the racetrack. Only invest what you could afford to lose without that loss having any effect on your daily life in the foreseeable future. The third question is the most important of the three. The list of personal qualities necessary for success include patience, self-reliance, common sense, open-mindedness, detachment, persistence, humility, flexibility, a willingness to do independent research, an equal willingness to admit to mistakes, and the ability to ignore general panic. Finally, it's crucial to be able to resist your human nature and your gut feelings. It's the rare investor who doesn't secretly harbor the conviction that he or she has the knack for predicting stock prices. It's uncanny how often we feel most strongly that stocks are going up when the opposite occurs. It's not that investors and their advisors are chronically stupid or unperceptive. It is that by the time the signal is received, the message may have changed. When enough positive financial news filters down so investors feel confident about the short-term prospect, the economy is about to be hammered. The trick is to discipline yourself to ignore your gut feelings. Stand by your stocks as long as the fundamental story of the company hasn't changed. If you can't, your only hope for increasing your net worth may be to adopt J. Paul Getty's surefire formula for financial success. Rise early, work hard, strike oil.
Chapter 5. Is this a good market? Please don't ask.
Each time after I've given a speech, somebody asks me if we're in a good or bad market. For every person who wants to know if Goodyear Tire is a solid or attractively priced company, four more want to know if the bull is alive and kicking. I always tell them the only thing I know about predicting markets is that each time I'm promoted, the market goes down. As soon as those words are launched from my lips, somebody else asks me when I'm due for another promotion. Obviously, you don't have to predict the stock market to make money in stocks. I've sat at my Quotron through some of the worst drops, and I couldn't have foreseen them if my life depended on it. In the middle of the summer of 1987, I didn't warn anybody, least of all myself, about the imminent 1,000-point decline. I learned in graduate school that the market goes up 9% a year. Since then, it's never gone up 9% in a year. I've yet to find a reliable source to tell me how much it will go up or down. Another theory is that we have recessions every 5 years. It hasn't happened. I've looked in the Constitution, and nowhere is it written that every 5th year we must have recession. I'd love to know when we're going into recession. Unfortunately, when Future Man comes to Boston, I'm always on the road. I'd be able to adjust my portfolio. Things are never clear until it's too late. We always seem to be preparing ourselves for the last thing that's happened. This penultimate preparedness is our way of making up for the fact we didn't see the last thing coming along in the first place. People began to worry the market was going to crash the day after the market crashed on October 19, 1987. It had crashed. We survived it, and now we were petrified there'd be a replay. Those who got out of the market to ensure they wouldn't be fooled the next time were fooled again as the market went up. I don't believe in predicting markets. I believe in buying great companies, especially undervalued or underappreciated companies. It doesn't matter where the Dow Jones Industrials average is. The market ought to be irrelevant. If I could convince you of this one thing, I feel this tape has done its job. I'd love to be able to predict markets and anticipate recessions. Since that's impossible, I'm satisfied to search out profitable companies. I've made money in lousy markets and lost money in great markets. Pick the right stocks and the market will take care of itself. I hope you'll remember the following points from this section on preparing to invest. Don't overestimate the skill and wisdom of professionals. Look for opportunities that haven't yet been discovered and certified by Wall Street. Invest in a house before you invest in a stock. Invest in companies, not in the stock market. Ignore short-term fluctuations. Large profits can be made in common stocks. Large losses can be made in common stocks. Predicting the economy is futile. Predicting the short-term direction of the stock market is futile. Long-term returns from stocks are relatively predictable and far superior to long-term returns from bonds. Common stocks aren't for everyone. The average person is exposed to interesting local companies and products years before the professional. Having an edge will help you make money in stocks.
This section is about how to exploit an edge and develop the story on a company. The first step is to determine what kind of stock you're considering. Six stock categories are discussed, including what you can expect to gain from each type. Developing the story requires some research. The importance of earnings to the eventual success or failure of a stock, how to monitor a company's progress, and how to evaluate the price-to-earnings ratio are elements of the story. Peter Lynch tells you how to develop the story and pick out the winners. Chapter 6, Stalking the Ten-Bagger.
The best place to look for a ten-bagger is close to home. The shopping mall and wherever you work are good places to begin. Ten-baggers like Dunkin' Donuts and The Limited were apparent at hundreds of locations across the country. The women shopping at the local New Limited outlet had a chance to see the opportunity, research the company, and buy the stock long before Wall Street got its first clue. The average person comes across two or three likely prospects each year. All along the retail and wholesale chains, people who make things, sell things, clean things, or analyze things encounter stock-picking opportunities. Do you receive a paycheck? Automatic Data Processing is a company which processes 9 million paychecks a week for 180,000 small and medium-sized companies. This was one of the all-time great stock-buying opportunities. The company went public in 1961 and has increased earnings every year. Automatic Data Processing sounds like the sort of high-tech enterprise I advise against, but it's not a computer company. It uses computers to process paychecks. Users of technologies are beneficiaries of high-tech. As competition drives down computer prices, firms like Automatic Data Processing can buy cheaper equipment. This reduces their operating expenses and leads to greater profits. Who had an edge on Automatic Data Processing? The officers and employees of the 180,000 client firms could have known about its success. In fact, can't think of an equivalent opportunity in your life? Let's say you're retired. You live 10 miles from the nearest traffic light, grow your own food, and don't have a television set. One day you have to go to the doctor because the country life has given you ulcers. This is the perfect introduction to Smith Kline Beckman, the makers of Tagamet. Hundreds of doctors, thousands of patients, and millions of friends and relatives of patients heard about the wonder drug Tagamet. Pharmacists dispensing the pills and delivery boys delivering prescriptions also heard about the drug. Tagamet was a boon for the afflicted and a bonanza for the investor. These users and prescribers had a big lead on Wall Street. No doubt some of the oxymorons on Wall Street suffered from ulcers themselves, but Smith Kline must not have been on their buy lists. From 1974 to 1976, the testing period for the drug, the price climbed from around $4 to $7. The stock sold for $11 in 1977 when the government approved Tagamet. From there, it shot up to $72 a share. Many people invest in the stock market in a manner similar to playing poker without looking at your cards. The edge is especially helpful when it comes to deciding when to buy shares in established companies. Let's say you own a Goodyear tire store. After 3 years of slow sales, you suddenly can't keep up with new orders. This is a strong signal to you that Goodyear may be on the rise as a stock. You already know Goodyear's new high-performance tire is the best in the market. You should call your broker and ask for the latest background information on the tire company. Don't wait for your broker to call you. When he calls, he'll want to tell you about a company like Wang Laboratories. What good is a Wang tip to you unless you work in a computer-related job? What do you know that thousands of other people don't know a lot better? If the answer is nothing, then you don't have an edge in weighing. But if you sell, make, or distribute tires, you've got an edge in Goodyear. I could go on for the rest of this tape about the advantages of knowing the industry you're involved in. On top of that, there's the consumer's edge. Whichever edge applies to you can help you to develop your own stock detection system outside the Wall Street channels. Remember, if you wait to hear it from Wall Street, you'll get the news late.
Chapter 7. I've got it. I've got it. What is it?
However a stock has come to your attention, the discovery is not a buy signal. Just because Dunkin' Donuts is always crowded doesn't mean you should buy the stock. Not yet. What you've got so far is a lead to a story that must be developed. You should treat this lead as if it were an anonymous tip left mysteriously in your mailbox. Developing the story is not difficult. It only takes a couple of hours. This homework phase is as important to your success in stocks as your previous vow to ignore short-term market gyrations. It is possible to make money in stocks occasionally without doing any of the research, but why take unnecessary chances? Remember, investing without research is like playing stud poker and never looking at the cards. Procter & Gamble is a good example of why you need to develop the story. Procter & Gamble makes Pampers. Pampers like Legs was one of the most profitable new products of the 1970s. Should you have rushed out to buy the stock on the strength of Pampers? No, not if you had begun to develop the story. In 5 minutes, you would have noticed that Procter & Gamble is a huge company. Pampers sales amount to a small part of the company's total earnings. Pampers made some difference to Procter & Gamble, but it was nothing like Legs did for a smaller company, Hanes. If you're considering a stock on the strength of a specific product, the first thing to find out is, what effect will the success of the product have on the company's bottom line? The size of a company has a great deal to do with what you can expect to get out of the stock. Specific products aside, big companies don't have big stock moves. You'll get your biggest moves in smaller companies. The first thing I do is establish the size of the company in relation to others in the industry. Then I place it into one of six general categories: slow grower, stalwart, fast grower, cyclical, asset play, or turnaround. These six categories cover all of the useful distinctions any investor has to make. Slow growers are usually large, mature companies. They are expected to grow slightly faster than the gross national product. You won't find a lot of 2 to 4% growers in my portfolio, because if companies aren't going anywhere fast, neither will the price of their stocks. Stalwarts are companies like Coca-Cola, Bristol-Myers, Procter & Gamble, and Colgate-Palmolive. These multi-billion dollar hulks are not agile climbers, but they're faster than slow growers. When you traffic in stalwarts, you can expect a 10 to 12% annual growth in earnings. In the market we've had since 1980, the stalwarts have been good, but not spectacular performers. If you own a stalwart like Colgate-Palmolive, and the stock's gone up 50% in a year or two, you ought to figure that's enough and think about selling. I always keep some stalwarts in my portfolio because they offer pretty good protection during recessions. Bristol-Myers went sideways during the 1981-82 period when the stock market fell apart. The fast growers are among my favorite investments. These are small, aggressive, new enterprises that grow at 20 to 25% a year. This is the land of the 10 to 100 baggers. Fast growers are high-risk investments, particularly the stocks of the younger companies, which tend to be overzealous and underfinanced. An underfinanced company with headaches usually winds up in Chapter 11. Fast growers are big winners in the stock market. I look for the ones with good balance sheets making substantial profits. The trick is figuring out when they'll stop growing. A cyclical is a company whose sales and profits rise and fall with changes in the economy. In a growth industry, business keeps expanding. In a cyclical industry, it repeatedly expands and contracts. Autos, airlines, tire companies, steel companies, and chemical companies are cyclicals. They flourish when we're coming out of a recession and into a vigorous economy. The stock prices tend to rise much faster than the prices of the stalwarts. The cyclicals suffer when the economy is going the other way. You can lose more than 50% of your investment very quickly if you buy cyclicals in the wrong part of the economic cycle. Cyclicals are often lumped together with the trusty stalwarts because most are large, well-known companies. Since Ford is a blue chip, one might assume it will behave like Bristol-Myers, another blue chip. It doesn't. The common stock of Ford fluctuates wildly as the company loses billions of dollars in recessions and makes billions during periods of economic growth. Bristol-Myers' earnings will not go down in a recession. Ford's earnings could disappear. It's important to know that owning Ford is very different from owning Bristol-Myers. Turnaround candidates are battered companies. They aren't slow growers. They are no growers. They aren't cyclicals that rebound. In fact, these companies may already be bankrupt. Turnaround companies are potential fatalities, like Chrysler. Chrysler was a cyclical that went so far down, people thought it would never come back up. Turnaround stocks can make up lost ground very quickly, as Chrysler has proven. An asset play is a company sitting on something valuable that you know about, but Wall Street is overlooked. The asset may be simple, like a pile of cash. Sometimes it's real estate. Pebble Beach was a great asset play. At the end of 1976, this stock was selling for $14.50 per share. There are 1.7 million shares outstanding, so the company was valued at only $25 million. Less than 3 years later, 20th Century Fox bought out Pebble Beach for $72 million, or $42.50 per share. After buying the company, 20th Century turned around and sold Pebble Beach's gravel pit, one of the company's many assets, for over $30 million. In other words, the gravel pit alone was worth more than what investors paid for the whole company in 1976. Companies don't stay in the same category forever. Fast growers lead exciting lives and then burn out. Sooner or later, they exhaust themselves and become slow growers and stalwarts. Some companies fall into two categories at once. Some, like Disney, have been in every major category. Putting stocks into categories is the first step to developing the story. You'll know what the story is supposed to be after you've correctly identified the category. The next step is filling in the details so you can intelligently guess how the story will turn out.
Chapter 8, The Perfect Stock. What a deal.
Getting the story is a lot easier if you understand the company's business. I'd rather invest in pantyhose than in fiber optics. The simpler it is, the better I like it. You never find the perfect risk-free company, the kind of stock I dream about. But you can recognize favorable attributes which will greatly increase your likelihood of success. The following discussion covers 13 of the most favorable attributes you should look for. The first attribute is that the company name is dull, or even better, ridiculous. Automatic data processing is boring, but not quite as boring as Bob Evans Farms. But even Bob Evans Farms won't win the prize for the best name you could give a stock. Pep Boys, Manny Moe and Jack, is the most promising name I've ever heard. It's better than dull. It's ridiculous. Who wants to put money in a company that sounds like the Three Stooges? No Wall Street analyst in his right mind would recommend a stock called Pep Boys, Manny Moe and Jack. Unless, of course, Wall Street already realizes how profitable it is. By the time Wall Street knows about it, the price is already up tenfold. The second attribute is the company does something dull. I love to find a company with a boring name that also does something boring. Crown Cork and Seal makes cans and bottle caps. What's duller than that? A company that does boring things is almost as good as a company with a boring name. Both together is terrific. Both together will keep the oxymorons away. Ultimately, the good news will compel them to buy in, and that always pushes the stock price higher and higher. The third attribute is that the company does something disagreeable. What's better than boring? The answer is boring and disgusting. A company that does something that makes people shrug, retch, or turn away in disgust is ideal. Take SafetyClean, for example. SafetyClean provides gas stations with a machine that washes greasy auto parts. Gas stations gladly pay for the service. What analyst would want to write about this? What portfolio manager want to have SafetyClean on his buy list? Not many, which is precisely what's endearing about SafetyClean. The fourth attribute is that the company is a spin-off. Spin-offs of companies into separate freestanding entities often result in lucrative investments. Large parent companies do not want to spin off divisions just to watch them fail. A spin-off failure brings embarrassing publicity, which reflects badly on the parent. Therefore, the spin-offs normally have strong balance sheets and are well prepared to succeed as independent entities. The greatest spin-offs of all were the Baby Bell companies created from the AT&T breakup. While the parent has been an uninspiring performer until recently, the average stock gain in the newly created companies was 114% from November 1983 to October 1988. When the dividends are added in, the return is more like 170%. This beats the total return of the market by more than twice. The fifth attribute is that institutions don't own it and the analysts don't follow it. If you find a stock with little or no institutional ownership, you've found a potential winner. Find a company no analyst has visited and you found a double winner. You can find these stocks in banks, savings and loans, and insurance companies. There are thousands of these opportunities, but Wall Street keeps up with less than 100. The sixth attribute is that there are negative rumors about the company, like it's involved with toxic waste and or the mafia. It's hard to think of a more perfect industry than waste management. Sewage and toxic waste dumps disturb people. Waste Management Inc., the largest company in the waste management industry, is a better prospect than SafetyClean because it has two unthinkable things going for it: the toxic waste industry itself and the mafia. Anybody who fantasizes that the mafia runs all the Italian restaurants, the newsstands, the dry cleaners, and the construction sites also thinks the mafia controls the garbage industry. This fantastic assertion was a great advantage to the earliest buyers of waste management stock. The shares were grossly underpriced relative to the actual opportunity. The seventh attribute is that there's something depressing about it. My all-time favorite in this category is Service Corp International, or SRV. Now, if there's anything Wall Street would rather ignore besides toxic waste, it's mortality. SRV does burials. SRV also pioneered the pre-need funeral policy. This is a popular layaway plan. It enables you to pay off your casket and funeral service now while you can afford it. SRV gets the money for its pre-need sales, and the cash continues to compound. This company was shunned by most professional investors. SRV executives had to beg the professionals to listen to their story. Here was the perfect opportunity. Everything was working. You could see it happening. The earnings kept increasing. There was rapid growth, almost no debt, and Wall Street turned the other way. The eighth attribute is that it's a company in a no-growth industry. Many people prefer to invest in a high-growth industry where there's a lot of sound and fury. Not me. I prefer to invest in no-growth industries like funerals. For every product in a hot industry, there are 1,000 recent graduates trying to figure out how to make it cheaper and better in Taiwan or Korea. This doesn't happen with bottle caps, oil drum retrieval, or funerals. In a no-growth industry, especially one that's boring and upsets people, there's no problem with competition. That gives you the leeway to continue to grow and gain market share. SRV already owns 5% of the nation's funeral homes, and there's nothing to stop it from owning 15%. The ninth attribute is that it's got a niche. I'd much rather own a local rock pit than 20th Century Fox. A movie company competes with other movie companies, while the rock pit has a niche. Owning a rock pit is very safe and very boring. But if you've got the only gravel pit in town, you've got a virtual monopoly. A rock pit is valuable because nobody can compete with it. The nearest rival owner may be two towns away. He's not going to haul his rocks into your territory because the trucking bills eat up his profit. I always look for niches. Drug and chemical companies have niches. Once a patent is approved, all the rival companies with the billions in research dollars can't invade the territory. They must invent a different drug, prove it is different, and then do 3 years of clinical trials before the government lets them sell it. The 10th attribute is that people have to keep buying the product. I'd rather invest in a company making drugs, soft drinks, razor blades, or cigarettes than a company that makes toys. Somebody can make a wonderful doll that every child must have, but every child only gets one. 8 months later, that doll is removed from the shelves to make room for the newest doll the children must have, manufactured by a different company. Why take chances on fickle purchases when there's so much steady business around? The 11th attribute is that a company is a user of technology. Why invest in a computer company that struggles to survive in an endless price war when you can invest in a company benefiting from the price war? Again, look at automatic data processing. As computers get cheaper, ADP can do its job cheaper. This results in an increase in profits. The 12th attribute is that the company insiders are buyers of the stock. There's no better tip-off to the probable success of a stock than that the people in the company are putting their own money into it. If you see someone with a $45,000 salary buying $10,000 worth of stock, you can be sure it's a meaningful vote of confidence. There's only one reason insiders buy. They think the stock price is undervalued and will eventually go up. The 13th attribute is the company is buying back shares. Buying back shares is the simplest and best way a company can reward its investors. If a company has faith in its own future, then why shouldn't it invest in it itself? Massive share buybacks occurred after the October 1987 market drop. This stabilized the market at the height of its panic. These buybacks reward investors over the long term. When a stock is bought by its company, it is taken out of circulation. The number of outstanding shares is reduced. This can have a magical effect on the earnings per share, which in turn has a magical effect on the stock price. If a company buys back half its shares and its overall earnings are constant, the earnings per share have doubled.
Chapter 9, Stocks I'd Avoid.
If I could avoid a single stock, it would be the hottest stock in the hottest industry. Hot stocks can go up fast. Usually they go way beyond any of the known indicators of value. Since there's nothing but thin air supporting them, they fall quickly. If you aren't clever at selling hot stocks, you'll watch your profits turn into losers. When the price falls, it falls fast. Remember what happened to disk drives? The experts said this industry would grow at 50% a year, and they were right, it did. But with 30 rival companies scrambling for the action, there are no profits. There's never been a hotter stock than Xerox in the 1960s. Copying was a fabulous industry, and Xerox had control of the entire process. In 1972, the analysts assumed Xerox would keep growing indefinitely. But the Japanese got into it. IBM got into it. And Eastman Kodak got into it. Soon there were over 20 firms making nice copy machines, and product prices collapsed. Xerox got frightened and bought several unrelated businesses it didn't know how to run. The stock lost 84% of its value. Contrast the poor stock performance of Xerox to that of Philip Morris. Philip Morris sells cigarettes, a negative growth industry in the U.S. Over the past 15 years, Xerox dropped from $160 to $60 a share, while Philip Morris rose from $14 to over $140. Philip Morris increases its earnings by expanding its market share abroad, by raising prices, and by cutting costs. Philip Morris has found its niche. negative growth industries do not attract flocks of competitors. Another stock I'd avoid is a stock in a company that's been touted as the next IBM, the next McDonald's, or the next Disney. The next of something almost never is, whether on Broadway, the bestseller list, the National Basketball Association, or Wall Street. In fact, when people tout a stock as the next of something, it often marks the end of the prosperity for both the imitator and the original. When other computer companies were called the next IBM, you should have guessed IBM would have some terrible times. It has. Today, most computer companies are trying not to become the next IBM. Sometimes profitable companies prefer to blow their money on foolish acquisitions instead of buying back shares. I call this process diversification. The dedicated diversifier seeks out merchandise that is overpriced and beyond his realm of understanding. This ensures maximum losses. Consider the story of Melville and Genesco, two shoe manufacturers. One successfully diversified and one diversified. 30 years ago, Melville was making men's shoes for its own family of shoe stores. Sales grew as the company began to lease shoe departments and other stores, most notably in the Kmart chain. After years of experience in discount shoe retailing, the company launched into a series of acquisitions. They always established the success of one before proceeding with another. Melville bought CVS, a discount drugstore operation, in 1969, Marshalls, a discount apparel chain, in 1976, and KB Toys in 1981. During the same period, Melville reduced its number of shoe manufacturing plants from 22 to 1. Slowly but efficiently, a shoe manufacturer had transformed itself into a diversified retailer. Genesco, on the other hand, went off in a frenzy. Starting in 1956, it acquired Bonwit Teller, Henri Bendel, Tiffany, and Crest Variety stores. Then it got into security consulting, men's and women's jewelry, knitting materials, textile and blue jeans. Genesco spread out into many forms of retailing and wholesaling while still trying to manufacture shoes. The company made 150 acquisitions from 1956 to 1973. These purchases greatly increased the company's sales. Genesco got bigger on paper, but its fundamentals were deteriorating. The difference in the strategies of these two companies ultimately showed up in their earnings and stock performances. Both stocks suffered from the 1973-1974 bear market. But Melville's earnings were growing steadily and its stock rebounded. It was a 30-bagger by 1987. Genesco's financial position continued to deteriorate after 1974. The stock has never come back. I get calls all the time from people who recommend solid companies for Magellan. Then they lower their voices as if to confide something personal and they say, "There's this great stock I want to tell you about. It's too small for your fund, but you ought to look at it for your own account. It's a fascinating idea, and it could be a big winner." These are long shots, also known as whisper stocks. Often the whisper companies are on the brink of solving the latest national problems, the oil shortage, drug addiction, or AIDS. The solution is either very imaginative or impressively complicated. Whisper stocks have a hypnotic effect. The stories usually have emotional appeal. These stocks may go up before they come down, but they are lousy long-term propositions. I've lost money in each one of them I've bought. They have great story, but no substance. That's the essence of a whisper stock. Another stock I'd avoid is in a company selling 25 to 50% of its wares to a single customer. If the loss of one customer would be catastrophic to a supplier, be wary of investing in the supplier. Disk drive companies like Tandon were always on the brink of disaster because they were too dependent on a few clients.
Chapter 10. Earnings, earnings, earnings.
Let's say you notice Sensomatic, the company that invented the tag and buzzer system for foiling shoplifters. The Sensomatic stock rose from $2 to $42 as the business expanded between 1979 and 1983. Your broker tells you It's a small company and a fast grower. You've reviewed your portfolio and found two stalwarts and three cyclicals.